Hey, it's time for our monthly sports show on the Larry Mueller Show. And today we start by taking a look at your athletic shoes. Roughly 60 to 70% of people wear shoes that don't fit. That's according to an analysis by the Journal of Foot and Ankle Research. Maybe you're one of them. Maybe I am. Larry Mueller here again. Nice to have you with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about choosing the right athletic shoe for your foot, your feet. And our guest is Madison-based podiatrist, Dr. Stephen Merks. He's a member and past president of the Wisconsin Podiatric Medical Association, plus a member of the American Podiatric Medical Association. So as we talk with Dr. Merks, I hope you'll join in. What kind of shoes are you walking or running or playing golf in? Share your footwear questions. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Stephen Merks, welcome. Nice to have you with us today.
Hey, thank you so much, Larry. It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, I tell you what, we got, I think, a lot to talk about. Every sport has its own shoe or shoes now. How important is it to have the correct shoe for an activity?
That's a great question. I think the shoe industry has gotten incredibly sports-specific in their offerings. And some of it is, you know, very apropos and very helpful. Cross trainers, court shoes have some stability for lateral movement sports, you know, going side to side, which is super helpful. The running shoe industry has really gotten big into these techie foams that are incredibly light and returning energy to the foot and helping with propulsion and making people faster. So I would say, just in general, as a podiatrist, for the majority of us, you know, that are, you know, just living our day-to-day lives and getting our steps in, a good running shoe is, you know, probably at the top of my wish list.
Yeah. Walk us through the anatomy of a shoe.
Sure. Yeah, I think if you ask this question to any podiatrist, there's really three things that we're looking at to, you know, speak to us about, is this a good shoe or not? And looking at the back of the shoe, at the heel counter, I want to have a little bit of stability there. I don't want it to be too flexible. I don't want it to be too soft where I can just flatten it out. And if you think about it, everything that's going on mechanically starts at the hind foot and the heel. And if that shoe is kind of hugging that heel and just lending a little bit of stability, that's a very good thing. And I definitely love to see that. Next, I would look at the sole construct. And I typically want to see that sole bend where the ball of the foot would bend. And that's the break of the shoe, which is at the metatarsal phalangeal joint. We don't want to see it fold up in the middle. That's the sign of a cheaper shoe. And I think we want to see that sole have some nice oomph to it. So not something that you can easily fold in half, but has just a little bend, just a little give. And then lastly, what I'm looking for is some inherent arch support and some stability. So I don't want to be able to take that shoe and be able to twist it like a wet towel. I want it to have some oomph so that it's going to, you know, hold up to what we're doing.
So three different areas. What about a good shoe fit? I mentioned the research that, what is it, 60 to 70% of us wear shoes that don't fit.
And I would have to say, from my experience, that's probably a conservative estimate, because there's not a day that goes by in clinic where I'm not having, you know, people, you know, throw their shoes on and check fit and telling them that they're not wearing the proper size. I think if people are going to err, it's usually on the side of being too small versus too large. And I think that what I look for is kind of a proper fit is having about a finger's breadth between the end of the long toe and the end of the toe box of the shoe. And I think in the article that we were, you know, kind of referencing, that's about, you know, about a half an inch, close to it. And, you know, that's a shocker for a lot of people who are literally right up to the edge of the toe box of the shoe. And we do want to have that ability to, you know, have a little wiggle room in the toe box and to, you know, have our toes breathe and not to be staircased together. And if you get that right sizing, the other thing that you're going to appreciate is that the widest part of your foot, that upper material isn't going to be overly snug or kind of tented against our foot. And I think that, you know, we've always had these little misconceptions about feet and about shoes. We definitely feel like that shoe should feel good right out of the box. It shouldn't be something that is needing to break in over a period of time to really gauge how well this actually fits. You should know right out of the chute. And I think that the other thing is when you go shoe shopping, if you haven't been measured in a long time, I think it's helpful to get measured. You know, look at both feet. You always have to fit the larger foot. And go shoe shopping later in your day or early evening when you've been on your feet a little bit. We all tend to have some amount of swelling that happens just over time with our feet being in a dependent position. And I would typically bring with the socks that you're going to typically wear with that shoe. So, you know, for our ladies and gentlemen, if, you know, you're coming from work and you're wearing a thin dress sock or you're wearing hosiery and then you're going to try on athletic shoes, that running sock is going to be typically a little thicker. And so you're going to want to try to gauge the size of that shoe with that, you know, more appropriate sock.
Hmm. Jim in Wasaki has a question that may relate to this. Let's go there. Jim, hi. Thanks for calling.
Good morning.
Morning, Jim.
I will be I've had a kidney transplant, and I'm going to be competing in the World Transplant Games coming up next month in Australia. One of the events I do, right now I hold the world title for my age group in race walking, but I need some new shoes for a race walk. And I was wondering if you had any specific recommendations.
So race walking is, you know, another one of those straight line sports, and it's going to be straddling the line between running and walking in regards to the amount of impact that the foot's going to take up, probably closer to running. And so I would probably recommend more of a running versus a walking shoe for you. I think you're going to get the shock absorption and cushion that you're going to need for that particular event. The shoe that you choose, we probably would recommend that there's a decent amount of sole stiffness or firmness. I think that's going to help a little bit with energy return and propulsion. So a major maker running shoe, I think, would be Brooks, Asics, Saucony, New Balance, you know, stay with the tried and true. And in these running shoes, they will have typically three categories. You're going to have a neutral running shoe, which is going to do equal parts shock absorption and cushion along with structure and stability. It's probably where I would pigeonhole most folks. There are some people that are very light, have high arched feet, poor shock absorbers. They're going to do better with a very light shoe that's high on cushioning and a little lower on structure. And then there's some of us that have those really kind of flattening, flexible feet that are going to really need a little bit more structure and stability. So if I had to just generically, you know, throw out a recommendation, I would say a running shoe is going to be the right play, probably a neutral running shoe, and stick with one of the major makers.
Jim, thank you very much for calling. Hey, good luck. Let us know how it goes at the championships. Appreciate it very much. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Heather messaged us. She wants confirmation from you that she needs different running shoes for different runs. 9 pairs are not too much, right? Her husband is questioning her.
Heather, I feel you. I've had my spouse question me, too, why I have so many pairs accumulating at the back door. So there is something to that. I do like to run, you know, marathons and half marathons for my, you know, sanity and health. And I think that for just day in and day out, you know, low mileage training, a good workhorse type running shoe is ideal. And these shoes may not be the lightest and fastest that you might want to throw on for running the event, but they're going to take the pounding that comes with putting in those miles to get ready for your event. And so these shoes are typically a little heavier. They have a little bit more foam, a little bit more cushion. There are days when you may want to do a little speed work, and then you might go to a lighter shoe. It's going to make you feel a little faster. It may have a little different sole construct, might be a little springier. And I think that then there are, you know, shoes for marathons, which you, or half marathon events, where you want to be able to do the miles and, you know, have something that's a little faster, and it's going to be kind of in the middle ground between the two shoes I mentioned.
So there you go. So you can tell your husband, so there, Heather.
I gave you some ammo. Exactly.
Actually, Charles in Chatfield, Minnesota, emailed and wants to know the type of shoe that I wear when I'm out. And I every morning I do sort of a walk jog for 3 miles. And I wear Brooks shoes, and I wear the Ghost. The Brooks Ghost are my favorite shoes, and I usually change those shoes out at about 500 miles.
I think you are using an excellent shoe. I think the Brooks Ghost is, you know, one of the classics, and, you know, definitely one of the most popular shoes that Brooks sells. And the reason for the popularity is that it is, you know, such a great, you know, all-purpose shoe. It kind of is going to be great for high mileage. It's going to be great to walk in. Got a great amount of cushioning to it. And I'm glad to hear, you know, that you're staying on top of your mileage. I think sometimes it can get away from us. And, you know, when it's getting harder, I think, with modern shoe materials to really tell just by looks, you know, that the shoe's kind of worn. So, yeah, I have some people that are hardcore, you know, they'll jot down the date that they, you know, bought the shoes. They'll throw it on the insole or on the shoebox. Some people, you know, journal and log their miles and keep a tally. But, yeah, 500 miles, if that's your day-in, day-out shoe, then it's ready to be replaced. I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, I have mapped my run on my phone and my watch, so that keeps a pretty good, accurate measurement of how far I go. Oh, man. Our guest today, Dr. Stephen Merks, Madison-based podiatrist, talking about athletic shoes. And again, you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert, our producer today, Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Talking athletic shoes today and your feet with Dr. Stephen Merks, Madison-based podiatrist. Great to have him with us today. And you can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Molly in Madison next. Molly, hi. Thank you for calling.
Taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Taking my call. Oh, good. Okay. So I have a little bit of a history here. So I have had three babies, and my feet appeared to get bigger, and I, with my third pregnancy, had a lot of heel pain. I went and saw a podiatrist, and they said, yeah, you're wearing, like, totally unsupportive shoes. So I just went and got some, you know, walking, running shoes. But then after, you know, after having this heel pain for years and having to walk in shoes and more than, if, you know, more than barefoot for 5 minutes, I had that pain. I said, I really want to treat the pain, not just the symptoms. And so went to see a chiropractor, actually, that kind of did some running and walking gait assessment and gave me a lot of really great exercises to strengthen my feet. I had kind of lost the connection between my brain and my feet because of that chronic pain. And I can now walk around barefoot, and I still do wear, you know, that supportive shoe. But I've found that having a zero drop, just because of my hypermobility and pelvic floor dysfunction, which is related to the kinetic chain of your feet, that I've had a lot of help just by working on those muscles. And I'm just curious, as a podiatrist, like, how do you handle that sort of thing? And like, what could you tell other people about that?
Thanks, Molly. Dr. Merks?
Yeah, no, thank you. So with our specialty, you know, we can sometimes be a little bit myopic in regards to, you know, foot and ankle, but Molly brings up a great point that, you know, it's all connected, and the kinetic chain is going to be essentially from the ground on up to the spinal column. And there's many points along the way where you can have some issues that can have effects, you know, downstream. And so on my end, you know, we look at, you know, the feet as the foundation, and are there some things going on that we can address that can potentially improve on situations, you know, up that kinetic chain. And so we look a lot at, you know, flattening and pronating and the effects that that can have on the knees and, you know, shin splints and sometimes up into the low back. A lot of times when we get people like Molly, they're having acute issues, and we oftentimes for these issues, you know, poo-poo being in bare feet and socks and, you know, hey, let's get you into something that's more structured, or even let's go with, you know, something like an arch support or an orthotic. Once we're on top of that acute issue, what she was saying about, you know, strengthening and, you know, focusing on gait and, you know, areas further removed that might need to be loosened, tweaked. You know, we've got great relationships with chiropractic and physical therapy that are so helpful with those things. And I think there are some sports medicine-minded podiatrists that are pretty good at, you know, evaluating gait and picking up on some hiccups, you know, that person may have. But I rely very heavily on my physical therapists, athletic trainers, and chiro. So she brings up a great point.
Yeah, Molly, thanks again. Appreciate it. Annie in Janesville, your turn. Hi, Annie.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, appreciate
Listen,
the call.
I want to ask about a couple of specifics. The doctor mentioned something about the stability in the back of the shoe, and I am currently in love with the Kizik, which is a step-in. And then also, for 25 years, I have shunned the plastic hoof, the Croc, but recently I bought a pair, and it's a very unique feel, and I'm wondering if the doctor could speak to those two things.
So the first, if I'm thinking correctly, the Kizik is the shoe that you can just slide your foot in, and it's got some firmness in the heel counter so that that doesn't fold up.
Is that correct?
Okay. So this is super helpful for patients that might have some limited mobility, or, you know, they're kind of addressing things like a back injury or a recent surgery. And so this is definitely a better construct than just slipping into something that's backless or flattening out the heel counters and just walking on top of those. And so you're getting a better fit, and you're getting more of the anatomy of an athletic shoe, a running shoe, versus just being in like an open slide or, you know, like a Crocs, like a quad. I've grown in my 22-year career to embrace the Croc. Not that I want to see people in Crocs all day long and as being your primary shoe, but for so many of my patients, and we saw this really happen during COVID, when people are home, that's, you know, the shoes come off and they're in bare feet or they're in socks. And there's so many reasons why this can sometimes not be the best default for somebody. You know, we talk about getting into a firm-soled clog, like there's a German company called Haflinger, and that's a great wintertime, you know, house shoe for somebody versus like a deer foam, you know, something that's really soft. I talk about some of these recovery slides and sandals that the runners like from Hoka and Ufu that are really plush, and they've got great arch support and a thick footbed. You know, these are great things versus being in bare feet. And the Crocs are the same way. If folks are used to being in that barefoot state, and we're preaching to them that, hey, you can't do that anymore because you have heel and arch pain, you have plantar fasciitis, it's a really hard sell for me to tell that person to be buttoned up in that hot running shoe all day long. And so it's healthy, I think, both physically and mentally for those folks to come home, kick off the running shoes, you know, kind of like Mr. Rogers, but rather than putting on the soft slippers, they're going to get into something that's got a little structure, and the Crocs kind of fit that bill.
Yep. I have a pair at home, Annie, and that's what I do. I like to put them on when I'm walking around the house. Thank you very much for calling. Again, you can join in 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Aaron in Sun Prairie emailed us and wonders, for a person with a bunion, is there a good sandal for support to recommend for summer? Would a flip-flop be better to help direct the big toe back in place rather than a slide-type sandal?
Great question. So I would say with bunion deformities where we've got, you know, a bump or prominence at the side of the great toe joint, sandal season, warmer weather is typically going to be an easier workaround versus, you know, wintertime when we typically have to have something to protect us from the elements. And so it's all about finding, you know, a model of sandal where the strap construct works, you know, for your anatomy. And we either have to have a slide type of fit where that slide is strap is just before that bunion bump or just after, or you can have some of the straps where that bunion just kind of nestles in between those straps. For me, I always am looking for something that has some redeeming qualities with some inherent arch support. And so, you know, there's some river sandals that work well for folks. Tiva makes them a good version of that. Chacos are another one that work real well. Birkenstocks, you know, that German maker, we talk about them all day long. And they've got models that have a deeper heel cup and varying degrees of arch support, which, you know, I find invaluable. From a stability standpoint, we love sandals that also have a strap in the back that, you know, just help fasten the foot and encourage a more normal heel-to-toe gait pattern. So the problem with having an open-backed sandal or slide is that you're going to have a tendency to kind of grip to keep that shoe on, and you're going to actually claw the toes, and you can exacerbate, you know, things like hammer toes. I don't know that a flip-flop or having that little, you know, thong in between the first and second digits really does anything to truly reverse, you know, what's going on with that bunion deformity and the big toe wanting to drift laterally towards the second toe.
I hate that thong in the middle. I don't use those.
Me too.
Oh, man. A listener emailed wondering, speaking of bunions, There's a newish bunion surgery called lipoplasty 3D bunion correction. Recovery time and complexity of surgery is supposed to be less than a traditional bunionectomy. Is that true? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So the lapoplasty is a trademarked system that facilitates performing a Lapidus fusion, and that's doing a midfoot arthrodesis. So it's kind of coming back one joint level from where we see the bunion deformity. And the reason why this is sometimes a better approach is because for larger deformities, for hypermobile deformities where there's a lot of play at that midfoot, or if that joint is oriented at the midfoot in an oblique fashion where it's kind of splayed out, that's kind of the crux of the matter. That's where the apex of the deformity is. And you're going to have a better result if you attack the deformity at its core. And it's this lever arm, and coming back further, you can really close down that widened angle. And it's a very powerful procedure. It's supposed to be better than picking maybe a lesser procedure and not quite getting things aligned the way they should. So the benefits would be a lower recurrence rate of, you know, truly correcting the deformity from where its, you know, genesis is at. The instrumentation that they use does allow an earlier return to weight bearing versus the conventional, you know, Lapidus fusions that we learned in residency, you know, 25, 30 years ago, where we would sometimes have people being non-weight bearing for 6 to 8 weeks. There are some surgeons that are weight-bearing their patients after a lapoplasty fusion, even at 2 weeks. You still have to give that bone 6 to 8 weeks to heal, so it's not anything that's miraculously going to, you know, get you in a shoe the next week or anything like that, but it does expedite things. It is kind of a better mousetrap, you know, that's been created.
Mm. Margaret emailed, she plays soccer and has had shin splints on and off her whole life. She bought a women's shoe and Curex insoles to help. Any other tips? Should she be focusing on form?
Soccer's tough.
Yeah, my daughter plays soccer.
Cleats, you know, outdoor cleats are conventionally, you know, horrible. They're flat. There's no inherent arch support. They're constrictive, and that's by design. Players want to have a snug fit. That helps with, you know, feel and touch of the ball. Incorporating an orthotic, a conventional foot orthotic, into a soccer cleat is very challenging due to those space constraints. The Curex insoles are one of the better over-the-counter arch supports that are out there, and they have some sports-specific models for soccer, for tennis, volleyball, I think. And the crux there is, you know, trying to do a very low-profile device that's going to work a little easier in the constraints of these shoes. An indoor soccer shoe is similar in that it's a relatively flat shoe, low volume. I think that from a form perspective, that's not a bad idea if, you know, there are contributing issues. Let's say somebody's very tight in their posterior musculature, so hamstrings or calves, that may contribute to compensation that's happening at the foot and leading to things like, you know, overuse of the heel and arch, plantar fasciitis. Long-term, you know, if you tune those things up, your foot's going to get a little boost or a little bit of a benefit. It's really tricky treating athletes that are in the midst of their sport and their seasons, and that all of these overuse injuries are going to benefit from some amount of, you know, relative rest. So we hate to shut down athletes entirely, but it's really hard to get over an overuse injury if you're not allowing things to rest and recover. And so that's where we may have that athlete do less of the hardcore training during the week, you know, at practices, maybe have them do more, you know, shooting drills, maybe doing a little bit of dribbling versus participating in the scrimmages and all the running and the working out that goes with it. And hopefully, you know, they'll be ready for game day. But duly noted, it's definitely a challenge in getting active athletes better.
And relating to inserts, Cannon Little Shoot emailed, his favorite running shoe store now recommends to most customers to buy $25 shoe inserts. And he, Ken, kind of thinks this is a scam. You pay more than $100 for running shoes. They should not need an insert if you pay that much money. What are your thoughts?
You know, I think he's not the only one that probably had that thought. And I do know that a lot of shoe stores, this is a big dollar item, you know, that is a major factor in their livelihoods. I think that it can be overdone. However, I think there is also a misconception out there in the general public that, hey, I bought this, you know, real high-tech shoe that cost me a pretty penny, and that should be all I need. The shoe is part of it, but a lot of times for foot pathology and, you know, specific, you know, injuries and issues, we need something in that shoe. And so heel and arch pain due to, you know, pronated or collapsed feet, we're going to recommend doing an orthotic. If somebody has some issues with, you know, ball of the foot pain, let's say they've got an arthritic great toe joint, there are some things that we can do with specific insoles like a turf toe insole to stiffen that area up right underneath the great toe joint, or to incorporate a metatarsal pad to offload the ball of the foot if we've got a pinched nerve or we've got an overloaded second metatarsal phalangeal joint. So I do think that sometimes there is a necessity, probably better to get that from your podiatrist or your therapist versus the shoe store, though.
Yeah, for sure. We were talking about restrictive shoes, or you were, a little earlier, and there are some athletic shoes that aren't really built for comfort in many ways. Ski boots, skates, that sort of thing. How healthy for our feet is it to wear them?
They come with a whole different set of challenges for sure. Ski boots, I think, not being a big skier, I know that there's not a lot of movement going on. There is a little bit side to side, and I know that there are people that swear by ski orthotics, and there's a way to just try to transfer your weight to lay down an edge and to, you know, kind of cut back and forth on the hill. Being, you know, in a very restrictive area, I typically leave ski orthotics up to the ski shops. They seem to have a pretty good handle on that. For our skaters, figure skaters, hockey players, there are some benefits sometimes to doing some things in the forefoot. If they have ball of the foot pain, great toe joint issues, and that's going to, again, be more of a minimalist, you know, insert with perhaps a metatarsal pad. A lot of our skaters have issues with the backs of the heels where they get some rubbing on the back of the heel counter of the skate. And a good skate fitter, skate shop is invaluable to help these folks out. They do some skate surgery. They can, you know, cut out the hard areas. They can pocket blowout areas for, you know, bony prominences. So I definitely appreciate those challenges are a little bit outside of what I do day in and day out. And so I rely on those folks to help me with those specialized athletes.
Yeah. Doris in Two Harbors has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Doris.
Hi, yes. I was happened to be listening, and then I was paying attention because I had a bunion surgery done 30 years ago. And then I have another remark. I wondered if you'd ever heard about this. I was surprised. First, I went to a podiatrist who said, off your feet for 6 weeks. I said, I can't do that. Then I read about in the paper in Chicago where I was living about a podiatrist working with the University of Chicago at their gait clinic. And I go, okay, I'm going to go see him if I can get an appointment. I did. He said, no problem. What he did with my foot was sort of, I don't know the name of it. It was so long ago. It was in the mid-80s. He cut into the bone at the bunion, sort of resected it, took a wedge out, put a pin in, and I had to stay off my foot elevated for like a day and a half. And the day after that, in a boot with a wooden bottom, I was going to work. It took, you know, a few weeks in that boot, a couple, three, I don't remember how many, and then I graduated to a larger sneaker, you know, larger size than my foot. And I really wasn't able to get into regular tight shoes for months that I've worn, but I was wearing these larger shoes. But I was walking in 2 days, and I'm shocked to hear that even with the best thing you're talking about, somebody to have to be off their feet for a couple of weeks. So I'm wondering if you ever heard about this. Isn't anybody doing this, what I had? And it was perfect from day one.
You know, she brings up a great point. She's talking about a procedure that she had done in the 80s. And, you know, I liken it to fashion where, you know, things kind of come in and out of vogue. And back in the day, minimally invasive surgery or MIS type surgery was very common. And there were some people where that's all they did, these small, you know, stab incisions using electric burrs to enact essentially an osteotomy or a cut in the bone, and then using no fixation or using minimal fixation. The advantages of a procedure like this were no big incisions, and you were essentially leaving the supporting structures around the joint intact, so you weren't having to incise through the joint capsule and dissect off collateral ligaments and things of that nature. So there was some inherent stability. There were some complications with these surgeries, and there was a shift in how podiatry and orthopedics did surgery and went to a more open visualized surgery. And with that came longer healing times, but I think the thought process was that it was being done correctly and was truly doing everything that needed to be done to get that deformity fixed and to have, you know, kind of long-term correction. Lo and behold, I would say this past 10 years, you're hearing more and more about a return to minimally invasive surgery for those reasons, you know, quicker recoveries, return to shoes, return to sport. And what's different now is that there is all of this instrumentation that's utilized to perform accurate cuts and placement and to introduce hardware where we didn't have that before. So this is something where a lot of very veteran practitioners are kind of going back to the drawing board, if you will, and they're taking courses and attending seminars and working with these companies and reps to get up to speed on these new systems to give people what they want.
And on that note, we're out of time. You're a marathoner, and I was at Grandma's Marathon in Duluth many years back. How's your training going, and are you getting yourself ready to run in Grandma's Marathon in Duluth?
I am slowly running myself back into shape. I thank you for asking. Yeah, I'm very excited, and I'm doing a little different training plan, and I'm a little older, so I'm hoping that we're going to get all our ducks in a row, and it's going to be a good one.
It's a hilly one in parts. Dr. Merks, it's been a pleasure. Will you come back and be with us again? Love to have you back.
I'd love to, sir. It's been a pleasure on my end as well.
Dr. Stephen Merks, our guest, a podiatrist based out of Madison, a member and past president of the Wisconsin Podiatric Medical Association. We'll get him back and we'll talk with him again. But now I've got a big question for you. How are your brackets looking? You're for the NCAA basketball tournament. Mine are not looking very good. We'll talk about brackets, and we'll talk about the men's and women's NCAAs. Maybe we'll get to the Packers. Lots more coming up with our next guest. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.